Welcome to Unique Connections at the Table. I'm Dr. Beverly Samways, and each episode we invite you to join the conversation and discover new ways of seeing the world, particularly in relation to those with learning disabilities. So pull up a chair, the table's set, and we're so glad you're here. Hello. Hi, Jenny. How are you doing?
Hello. I am good, thank you. My in-laws are coming to stay very soon. I thought it was tomorrow. So I've been rapidly getting the house ready for tomorrow, and I discovered that it's next Thursday instead. So, which kind of adds the pressure of keeping my house very tidy for a week, or having to go through exactly the same as I went through yesterday and tidying it again next week. And I can't work out which is better or worse here. But yeah, that's wow. Been my week. How about you?
But that feels like you now have the added bonus of just being able to enjoy a beautifully clean house for yourself, right?
I have a toddler, so a beautifully clean house stays beautifully clean whilst he's not in the house. So that'll be today when he's at nursery. And as of 4 p.m. this afternoon, you know, it'll be trains and it'll be Duplo and it'll be sand and all of these things. So it'll be beautiful until about 4 p.m.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I did have like a major, I can't call it spring clean, winter clean at the weekend. But I did that thing that I was chatting to my friends about, because we've all been doing it recently, where you start a major project, you know, you get the, we had the rug up on the sofa and everything. And I'm thinking, right, I'm really going to go for this. So you sort of pulled apart a room in order to clean it. And then from the moment that you've pulled the room into disarray, you totally run out of energy. You look around, you're like staring around a room that's been absolutely ruined, thinking, I just don't want to do this anymore. What was I doing? You know, when you do like, oh, I've never could sort out, and then you pull everything upside down, and then you're like, I just want to lie down now. So, but anyway, I saw it through. So we have
done.
One of those things, you know, when you think a room doesn't seem dirty and then you clean it and then you feel like, I don't know how I was living in it before.
Yeah. We have a cleaner once a fortnight and it always looks so clean once she's come. But I'm also like, how did I not notice beforehand? Yeah. That it was like this. Of course I'll keep it this clean. And obviously I don't. This is why I have a cleaner. Absolutely. It's absolutely. But going backwards a minute then, I love that analogy. I love that analogy of like taking everything up, shaking it all up and then going, what do we do now?
Yeah.
Because I think we've both worked, it might be so much of some of the organisations that we've both worked in sometimes, where it feels like if we explore, in our world, if we explore trauma too much, we're going to open everything up and then we're all going to run out of energy. Or the staff who've opened it all up are all going to leave.
Yeah.
Or there's no, you know, like if you'd been like, actually, sorry, friends, I'm going to leave the house like this because I'm going to go away to a conference for a week. They would have been like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
But this same fear happens in organisations. I've come in to work in places where it's been, okay, you can do something with this one young person, but you can't speak into us as an organisation.
Right.
Because we can't tolerate what that'll be like when you leave. We can't tolerate the mess that could be created and what that makes us think about.
Yeah, do you know, Jen, that is golden work. I can't believe how quickly you landed that back into a conversation about trauma. It was so true. It does feel like there's that initial energy, isn't it? Like, let's do this. Let's get back down to the roots and the foundations. Let's build from the ground up. And then you pull everything up to do that. And everyone's like, oh, no, it's all much dirtier than I thought. And I just want to put it all back again and forget that I ever saw this. And it's like, yeah, it definitely feels like that.
And that feeling of, I don't know what to do with all of this now.
Yeah.
Am I going to make this worse somehow?
Yeah.
One of my favourite stories is when I decided to change a room around and I fell over something and broke two of my toes. And so then I'm like, I absolutely have no ability now to be able to put everything back into place. This kind of thing, like, I've absolutely made this worse. And so often, this is what we hear when we speak to staff, isn't it? I don't want to start a conversation about trauma with a young person because I'm going to make it worse.
Exactly. And what if I break a toe and then I can't carry on? Yep.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We talked a bit last week about how fear moves around and how we can have that kind of, I'm afraid, and therefore you're picking up my fear and you're afraid.
Yeah.
But it can also start with the staff as well. I'm afraid of having this conversation with you. And then the young person comes in going, oh, this isn't a safe conversation. This isn't a safe person. How can they ask me, how am I doing today? Yeah. Because actually, I don't know if they can tolerate what I'm going to say.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, so we talked about that, like, concern, wasn't it, that so many people with learning disabilities, that the conversation around trauma is not there. The bit that I didn't say last week that's, like, probably because it blows my mind, I also have to take a moment when I remember this, is that for people with learning disabilities, they are 4 to 5 times more at risk of experiencing, having a traumatic experience than somebody without a learning disability. The risk is so high that by the time somebody with, particularly someone with severe learning disability, gets into adulthood, you may as well assume that they've had a significant traumatic experience. And if we think about that alongside the fact that trauma is so rarely talked about in favour of rather talking about behaviour or diagnosis, I just find that, like, mind-blowing, like a collective avoidance across the whole sector. And I definitely, I've been working with young people with learning disabilities for all of my professional life, really. And I definitely remember thinking early on, we seem to know a lot about behaviour, but we don't ever seem to talk about emotion. But oftentimes, you know, I was aware that I'd be working with a young person who was, I remember a young lady coming in and she absolutely lost it. I mean, she'd just come to live with us and she, I think two of us supported her to use the bathroom. She needed support for the bathroom. And she lost it. She hurt both of us so badly and she hurt herself. But all the way through, she was sobbing, just sobbing her heart out. And she was just really, really frightened and griefy because she left her home and she'd moved she'd moved away from her parents. And it wasn't challenging behaviour. It was like unbearable grief and fear, because two people she didn't know were helping her to use the bathroom. I just remember thinking, like, early on, where would those conversations go? I don't understand why we don't talk about that. But we really didn't talk about it because nobody knew what to do about it. Or nobody talks about grief or loss and learning disabled people with, you know, people leaving home. People do leave home in their childhood and their teens to go and, because the family are overwhelmed by this, you know, by the levels of support they need. So, yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? 4 to 5 times.
Yeah.
4 to 5 times. Wow. And when we say it like that, it feels so big that we kind of go, why on earth are not all decisions and all actions coming from that place?
I agree. But it's still the case that if you say about a young person, you know, I wonder whether this is a trauma presentation, like, we experience it, don't we? We'll have people saying, what? Why would they be traumatised? Nothing's bad has happened to them. Like, nothing, this has got no reason to be traumatised.
I really like Gabor Mate's big T trauma and little T trauma. Because I think so often we can say, okay, trauma, that's something with a big capital T, that's somebody who has experienced a war zone. Or somebody who has experienced significant abuse.
Yeah.
Or something that was sort of maybe ongoing, but a one-off big event that we would all say, absolutely no way would I be able to cope with that and come out not impacted by it. But then we have a little T trauma, which is that consistent not meeting needs or consistent lack of something that is very important to us that provides safety, like being cared for consistently, but also that continual moving between accommodation or continually feeling like my needs are too much for somebody else.
That's right.
All of those things are that little T trauma.
Yeah.
But to consider that for young people can also then lead staff to need to consider that for themselves.
Absolutely.
Because they consider that a young person has experienced this and we're calling this trauma, does that mean that I also have?
That's absolutely right. I also was thinking about like what we might like if almost like if we if the if we were in their shoes, the things that we might find to be truly terrifying, that we probably are just we can't think about it because it's part of their ordinary life. I think of a family member who was in hospital for a while and needed help with personal care, and they had an experience where two people came to support them with personal care, and the two people supporting spoke to each other, but they didn't address them at all, and they had a trauma response. So they were terrified and furious in a lengthy complaint when it was over, but were not able to speak up at the time because it was so frightening for them to be manhandled physically by two people who could not. I mean, they experienced it as dehumanizing. But I think how often that might happen to somebody who has learning disabilities, who maybe can't speak. They are handled physically as if there's no one inside, as if they are a job to be done and a task to be accomplished, but not a person. And that it's only got to happen, you know, once to the person I knew for that to be traumatic. But for some of the young people we support, that has happened just too many times in their lives. So there's that kind of thing.
Yeah, because the other similar one is the one that's impacted us this week, where my son's key worker was off sick from nursery. And he's incredibly attached to her, won't really go to anybody else, cries when she goes to the toilet, this kind of thing, like a really strong attachment. And she wasn't there. And he was suddenly lost, going, I don't know who to talk to. I don't know who's going to look after me today. And so often there is a change around in staffing or a changing around moving a young person to somewhere else, moving around those key members of staff. We know that staff often don't stay in these careers for a long time. Care staff may move and people go, oh, okay, we don't need to talk to this young person about it. They won't notice. There's always staff here. All of these kind of things we've heard. They don't mind. That's okay. We don't experience with them what the grief and the loss is of that person not being there. And then we get confused why there is a trauma response happening about this person not being there.
Yeah, absolutely right. And we often see that in subtle ways. It's often the case with particularly people with like severe learning disabilities, that when a new person comes into their lives, that they will be, I've seen it both ways. I've seen young people who are just good as gold for a new person, just won't put a foot wrong. And you can see that like anxious attachment of like, I just really need you to like me and to trust me. And I don't want you to have any assumptions about me. So I'm just going to be, and often that will be their favourite person for a while. And the person like thinks, oh my goodness, I'm great at this job. I'm doing a great job. And it makes them want to stay. And you can see that something is working itself out in the young person, that they are so frightened of people leaving their lives and trying to hold on to people for as long as possible. But we were going to talk about how this, in this, they're like what happens in the staff as well, isn't it? Because this is, so we've thought quite a bit about that, like trauma, the levels of trauma in young people with learning disabilities and autism. But the next layer of complexity is the sort of direct support professionals, as they call them helpfully in the US. And we had a lot of conversations about this in the US. Firstly, massive problems with recruitment and retention of direct support professionals in the US as well as in the UK. And it definitely feels like a pandemic, post-pandemic concern that in the, you know, after the pandemic, people got through in the pandemic, and then after the pandemic, people started making big choices like, I'm going to move house. I'm going to end my relationship. I'm going to start a new relationship. I'm going to change careers. I'm going to retire early. You know, we have people retiring at like 50, 55. Like, they were just like, I'm done. I am done with work. But we also had a lot of people who thought, I don't have to go to work. I can work from home. And so people finding jobs that facilitated that. And you cannot do direct care from home. But so we had loads of really experienced staff leaving the care sector after the pandemic, both in the US and the UK. But we also, those that stayed, if you think about the staff that weathered the pandemic and are still in care, they weathered a traumatic experience through the pandemic and they are still there. And so we have to accommodate the idea that those care staff that have had the longevity and the tenacity to stay in the sector may be carrying some residual trauma from having done that. In fact, there's been some research recently, and John Keyes has done some in the US, I think there was some done in Scandinavia, around the levels of trauma of people, of direct support professionals. And essentially, direct support professionals have higher rates of trauma than the general population. They are also more likely to have a traumatic experience at work than people in the general population. So they are both bringing more trauma into the job on average, and they are more likely to experience trauma as part of their work. So we have this sort of not very but not very well thought about, not very well talked about reality that we have probably very high levels of trauma in young people who are being cared for by staff who have higher rates of trauma than the general population.
We talked last week about that moment of when we might get a response in ourselves. So that feeling of you're about to cross the road and then a car comes, and for the rest of the day you can be a bit wobbly. And I'm thinking about how difficult it is to do a care job in those moments, day in, day out. That feeling of going, actually, I'm not contained in myself. And I can imagine that there is a feeling of staff of I have to go through the motions. I just go through, I turn up at work, these are the things I do. And when we're going through the motions, we're not connected to ourselves, we're also not connected to the other people around us.
That's right. And that's when it does become a job to do and tasks to complete rather than a person to care for. And I think, you know, of the a lot of the work that we do. And I mean, if we're going to meet a young person who we've been asked to assess or to work with, that's probably like 75% of what we're doing is regulating ourselves, isn't it? Because we understand that this child is going to meet us and communicate with them. We're going to find that point of connection, which is everything that we're about. Like, you know, our goal when we meet a young person is, can I make a connection with them? Because we believe it's always there to be found, even if it's not clear or obvious from their presentation. In order to make the connection, us two work together to regulate ourselves. But if you're working with some residual trauma, or you're going into a space that feels traumatized, like that becomes less and less a priority, or you just don't worry too much about whether you're regulated. And so you go into a space where a young person's not regulated, you're also not regulated, and so it starts to feel chaotic. And I think, you know, sometimes you know, I listen to staff talking about what sounds like utter chaos, where you've got one child, you know, bouncing off another child who's bouncing off staff members who are, you know, just incident after incident, and this has become normalized. It's become an ordinary way of operating. It becomes expected that staff are hurt at work, or that there's people off sick because they've been hurt by a child. And this is what we do. This is how we operate. And that's a scary world to be in, both for the staff and for the young people. And once we normalize fear as part of our job and our work, then it's, well, no one's safe, are they?
We also have to normalize the language of regulation and dysregulation,
Yeah.
because we're saying that you and I work hard when we're working to stay regulated, but
Right.
that's because we know in ourselves what regulation and dysregulation look like. But if you are in a continual state of dysregulation, you don't even know that you're there because that's become so normal for you.
That's right. And we also know it's normal to feel dysregulated in these spaces. That's why we're working hard. We're not like, I'm just always in a regulated state. You know, we walk into a room, we can feel everybody's nervous, everybody's a bit worried. Maybe people are a little bit worried. What on earth what are they going to do? The child's really on edge. So that's all impacting us. Like, and so that's why we're working hard, because we're like, what are we doing? Like, trying to think what I'm doing inside. Usually I'm trying to name what I'm feeling. What can I feel in the room? I can feel fear. I can feel intimidation. I can feel suspicion. Okay, so that's what we've got here. They're just emotions. They're not attacking me. I'm going to feel them. I'm also going to hold them. And then I'm going to remember that they are not me, that they are just emotions, things moving in and out of my body, and they're affecting the way my body feels and maybe the way my mind is working. But I have peace inside me, that I can intentionally use to overwhelm those feelings. And I can bring peace into this space, and I can bring calm into this space, and like actually intentionally, internally, moving myself into those spaces. And also, we do that together quite a lot, Jen, don't we? So, yeah.
Absolutely. I think co-regulation is so incredibly important, but it takes at least one person to be regulated to be able to do that.
Yeah.
But on top of that, it takes the organisation as a whole to attempt to be regulated.
Right.
Because we can have conversations with direct staff
Yeah.
who may not have the capacity within themselves due to their trauma background to be able to regulate. And but they will then need leadership above them who are able to do that for themselves to offer that space of that co-regulation. So if they have a difficult conversation, a difficult encounter with a young person, to
Yeah.
know that there are staff above them who are able to regulate them offers that safety.
Absolutely right. So this is like not just, we work together on this stuff, isn't it? This is relational work. It's not something you can do as a lone. There's no mavericks in this game, is there? There's no lone rangers. So just as you and I work together, I often think of what we do is sometimes like a microcosm of what we're then going to invite the organization to do. I think about a young man we went to see ages ago, and he was just chaotic, absolutely chaotic in his all around the room, couldn't settle in anything. And then he finally settled and was moving a car along the window sill, but still agitated in himself. And I remember moving towards him and thinking, like, I know Jen's got me. Like, I couldn't see you, but you were standing behind me. I think you were talking to somebody, and I just knew that you wouldn't let your eyes off me, and that you had got me held. And because you had me held, I could then hold the boy. And in fact, if you remember, the most extraordinary thing happened, he actually climbed into my arms and just lay in my arms, and it totally still, like a baby. And then we began to understand what was happening for him, that he was still needing to be co-regulate, to have to feel like he was not just with the person that was regulating him, but almost there was no separation, like a baby would with a mother. And the deep, deep, deep emotional need he had to experience safety and regulation. But that, like, you held me, I held the boy. And that's a lot of times what we're asking organisations to find a way to do, isn't it? That the staff are going to hold the child. And so who holds the staff? And so, like, there's that next level, isn't there, of building organisations around this concept of regulation and safety, where the organisation can come in. You know, if you have a team that's, like, experiencing chaos or experiencing, like, disorder, that you've got enough peace and safety and calm in the management that they can come in and say, we've got you. Like, we know it's hard and we know that what you're doing is really difficult, but we have absolutely got you.
Reminds me of how we also have our external support as well. So we both have external supervision.
Yeah.
We have an external team who we can contact. We can say, we need some insight into this. We need some support around this organisation. And they offer that containing of us as well.
They do.
Because they offer that to us, we can offer that to the leadership of the organisation.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
So when we offer a package, we offer both the work with the direct staff, but also the work with the leadership overall.
Yeah.
Because we know that actually they need the containing too. They need those spaces to kind of go, all right, let me explore what this was like for me when this thing happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we always have this, like, double dual model where we work with the organisation. And so I guess it's probably, so if we pull that back again into that sort of trauma language and fear language that we're talking, you know, we were talking before about somebody's traumatised, they're in a fear state. But we can't, sometimes we see that presenting in organisations, don't we, where the organisation is not regulated. They have collectively, so we would talk about an organisation organised around trauma, by which we mean that their organising principle has become by default a fear state. Mm-hmm. So they are either in a fight mode where there's lots of conflict, and or a flight mode where they are avoidant or defended against some of the realities, or they're in a freeze state where they have just shut down and stopped thinking. And I guess really all that means is that the organisation has lost touch. You talked about the upstairs last with the upstairs of their mind, their thinking, their problem solving, and instead they're in a reactive defensive mode. Yeah,
but we won't hear an organization say we're organized around trauma. We'll hear them say there's pockets that are just a bit toxic.
Yeah,
or we'll hear people say, I just come to work to do work, I'm not here to make friends or to get to know anybody.
Yeah,
or they'll say, I come in, I do my job and I leave. Or that feeling of focusing on the tasks that don't matter. So that kind of busy work. Okay, I'm just going to make sure this spreadsheet's really tidy and I have a nice smart office. I'm just going to make sure all these files are done, everything's clean. Anything it is that's going sort of doesn't really make a difference, but is wholeheartedly disconnecting from other people.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, we've seen probably fairly, like, significant expressions of that, and we all heard organisations talking about that. We've worked with teams who barely have any relationships between their people, are just working in silos. There's no, the bridges are down, the connections are broken, I think oftentimes as well, people just, particularly at leadership level, it often presents that leaders feel completely overwhelmed and exhausted, like they fantasize about leaving the job basically. Yep. Like, maybe they stay because they know that's their job, that's their call, that's their vocation. Yep. Like, they're just like they live for the weekends, they live for the holidays, they're totally exhausted. And at the end of the day, probably think, well, I survived another day, rather than I built anything or I just survived, I got through.
I think the one that stands with me is when I hear them say, I fantasize about falling down the stairs and breaking my leg and then being off work.
Yeah,
so it's not even, I can comprehend fantasizing about leaving.
Yeah.
It's fantasizing about actually, I would rather something painful happen to me.
Yeah.
That was tangible rather than the what feels like the pain of this whole organization. You know, I began this by saying sort of my in-laws are coming. And I know that when we visit them, they spend a whole load of time tidying the house and getting it all ready. So this has kind of seeped into me that if they're coming, I have to do the same.
Right.
And it's interesting how things happen generationally, isn't it? That actually sort of the most senior or the oldest people in an organisation who've been there the longest set a culture. And whether or not we want to buy into it, we sometimes do unconsciously. We do because there is a cost to considering differently.
Yeah.
And you've also got to know another option to consider a different option. So we will talk to direct support staff who, when we offer them, what would it be like to talk about trauma? What would it be like to talk about this loss with this young person? They kind of go, I've got permission to do that because I've never heard the leadership do this. I've never seen people above me do it. I don't know if this is okay. Can I do this?
Yeah. And I think one of the, I mean, when we talk about like organisations organised around trauma, it can sound like, oh my goodness, like how do you ever come back from it? But I feel like sometimes naming that stuff is really helpful because you can have a staff member who's in survival mode, you know, they're in those spaces where they're like, oh, I just hope I get flu because I can stay in bed for 6 weeks. Like all of that, like just in a desperate flight mode. And what they think is I'm incompetent, I'm inadequate, I'm not strong enough. They've blamed themselves for it and they're holding all the responsibility for that. But actually what's happening is that it's a product of the environment and the culture that they're in. Yeah. And so I remember talking to a staff member who was like, every day I come into work and like I psych myself up. I'm determined to be positive. I'm determined to work hard. I have a list of jobs in my head. I walk in the door and I feel like I can't think straight. I can't pull myself together. All my energy is sapped the minute I cross the threshold. What is wrong with me? And it had really distressing her that she was that she couldn't pull herself together once she crossed the threshold of the organization. And just saying to her, it's not you, that's not you. That is because we're in a space where it's hard to think, where dysregulation has seeped all over the place, and it's a very difficult space for anybody to think. Everybody feels chaotic here. Everybody feels like they've lost their purpose and vision here. It's okay that you feel like that. You're not broken. There's something that has got inside of the culture of the organization. We can rebuild it together. And I remember watching this, like all the worry and anxiety just draining off this person as we talked about that. And instead she realized, okay, something's wrong and it's not just inside me. And we can rebuild it together. Like it's possible to rebuild something here. And so I think that, like, that's again, it would, like we talked in the last time, didn't we, about naming the problem so that we can find the right solution. And sometimes just saying to an organization, like, this is everything, like the kids are overwhelmed, the staff are overwhelmed, actually you as an organization are overwhelmed. So let's just sit with that for a minute, recognize it, and then we can start rebuilding something.
And it is possible. I think we can get stuck so much into it's always going to be like this.
Right.
Or externalising the problem. If only we had more money, it wouldn't be like this.
Yeah.
And instead we're coming in saying, actually, that isn't the case. There are absolutely things that we are able to do.
Yeah.
That we can do and that will make a difference.
And I think that, like, that is why I love talking about this stuff. And I love because... like trauma's recoverable on every level. It's not quick. There's no medication just going to make it go away. There's no fancy plan that's going to fix it all, but it is recoverable. It's recoverable through process and through predominantly through relationship and connection. And so that's, I feel like this is one of the most hopeful conversations for this sector, particularly these spaces, homes and schools that are caring for young people with severe learning disabilities, and who are feeling overwhelmed. I feel like the conversation around trauma is so hopeful because there's recovery is possible.
Yeah, and I know next week we're going to be talking about how you've seen this in practice. So, what it is that you've seen in America, how you've seen some projects saying this is what works for us, and this is how we are aiming to do this. Because I think otherwise we can just hear it as going, okay, so now there's more work for me to do to try and recover this. And I think we really want to speak, hopefully, of the confidence it is recoverable. And yes, that takes work. However, the work is worth it. It isn't just, and
Absolutely.
here are more things to put on my tick list.
Yeah.
Here are examples of some of the work that has been done that has made a huge difference at recovering from trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. Good note to end on.
Indeed.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. Before you go, can you help us with something? We want to make sure these conversations reach the people who need to hear them. So if there's someone you think would benefit from listening to this, we would just love it if you shared it. See you next time.